Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I discuss a recent paper published in the American Journal of Psychiatry entitled, "Must Psilocybin Always Assist Psychotherapy?" This is a potentially provocative article, and you'll hear Reed and I try to set the table for the discussion carefully. All in all, we tried to have a rational, level-headed discussion about what we think research data suggests regarding the efficacy of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and whether or not psychedelics can be therapeutic outside the envelope of psychotherapy. If you've got thoughts, feelings, reactions to the article, to this discussion, you're welcome to email us at ptfpodcast@numinous.com, or if you're watching on YouTube, you could leave a comment below. If any of you who are listening are looking for good training and education pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, you can check out Numinous's education programs if you click on the link in the show notes, or you can go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection, and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. And of course, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing to the show on whatever podcast app you are listening to us on, or if you're watching us on YouTube, you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can leave us a rating or review. Thank you to those of you who have already left us ratings and reviews. We really appreciate that. And you, of course, you can share the episode with someone you think might enjoy listening to it. Without further ado, here is our discussion about the article. How you doing, Reed?
Doing well. Thanks, Steve. How about you?
I'm also well. Today, we're going to talk about a potentially button-pushing or controversial article that just came out in the American Journal of Psychiatry.
Ooh, I love triggering things.
Right. It's called "Must Psilocybin Always, Quote, Assist Psychotherapy?" This is authored by Guy Goodwin et al., Dr. Goodwin being the chief medical officer of Compass Pathways, I believe.
Yep.
And so this is an article that was actually brought to my attention by Compass staff. I serve as a mentor for Compass therapists that are on the Compass Pathways psilocybin trials. Mm-hmm. So this is an article that they sent out and said, "Hey, take a look at this. What do you think?"
Yeah.
So I thought it might be apropos to discuss an article like this on a podcast called Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is by way of like disclaimer, trigger warning, perhaps not a real trigger warning, but this is somewhat of a semantics debate. And I think it's important to be precise with our words and also important not to be too obsessive or divisive. It's kind of, you know, a sneak preview of my stance, but I also love to peek underneath the hood of these kind of things and see, where does the evidence lie? Can we really back up the claims we're making, especially when we work in clinical fields, right?
Yeah, I think it's healthy. It's healthy to, again, and also like we are accustomed to saying on the podcast, like our guest Dick Schwartz said in our previous episode or one of our previous episodes, all parts are welcome. So all reactions are welcome. Yeah. I'm trying to be welcoming of all my various reactions to to this article, and would be interested in feedback. So if any of you listeners have some thoughts or feedback about this article or the way we discussed it, you're welcome to email us. But
let's give all your parts the mic on this podcast, right, Steve, and have a fun little debate.
They are all welcome. So how's that for a juicy preamble? I thought I would just read the summary. It's not a very long article, but I felt like it was well written and articulate. But the summary reads as such. In summary, quote, "psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy does not capture the true mechanism of change facilitated by psychedelic experience." How's that for triggering? "The effects observed thus far in the best controlled studies of psychedelic treatment must be attributed to the drug itself and not to psychotherapy." We'll discuss why they make that claim. In the case of psilocybin, for example, let us say simply psilocybin treatment. To continue to use PAT, or psychedelic-assisted therapy phrase, at this stage risks confusing and impeding the development of serotonergic agonists as medications at psychedelic doses. We can think more clearly without it.
They do say serotonergic agonists, so they are not including, as they explain in the paper, MDMA-assisted therapy in this opinion piece. Right. It's a commentary published in a very reputable journal, mm-hmm. right? This was in the American Journal for Psychiatry, right? Yeah. The Green Journal, as we call it. And I also like to look at who is writing a given paper, especially mm-hmm. when it's a commentary or opinion piece. And mm-hmm. you mentioned Guy Goodwin, the lead author. There are four authors. Guy is a well-known psychopharmacologist from the UK, has done tons of clinical trials, and as you also mentioned, is chief medical officer at Compass. He was also the lead author of a pretty important psilocybin paper describing an earlier Compass study, the single dose of psilocybin plus psychological support for TRD that came out, I don't know, in the last year or so, that compared 1 milligram of psilocybin as their placebo versus 10 milligrams versus 25 and showed some significance in giving 25 milligrams, not 10
right.
for depression. Yeah. And then I guess next would be Charles Nemiroff, who I know I've met in my psychiatry training, and he's a bit of a controversial figure, a bright but controversial guy, because he has been so involved in not only drug company funded research, but consulting. And there was this, do you remember hearing about a Senator Grassley and a kind of a crusade he was on to expose payments made to academic psychiatrists? Mm-hmm. His main two targets were Charles Nemiroff, head of Emory's psychiatry department at the time, this is several years ago, and Alan Schatzberg at Stanford. And because of that investigation, Charles Nemiroff actually, who's in Austin now at UT Austin, the department chair, he actually lost his post as chairman in, at Emory, and was not allowed for 2 years to submit NIH grants.
Oh, wow.
I'm just giving the facts here. Right. I think Nemiroff has done great work, and he will admit he ran into some trouble with appropriate disclosure on the amount of payments he was getting. And he was since made chairman at University of Miami, which was kind of controversial. People were trying to suggest that that was done because he's great at raising money and getting drug company money, which he is. But then he since has gone to UT Austin to head the department, and the other author, what's his name is?
Gregory Fonzo.
Yeah, Greg Fonzo is a psychologist, head of the psychedelic research program at UT Austin. And then the other author is Katya Ekaterina. How do you say her last name?
I'm not even going to try.
yeah. Malivsky or something. Yeah, she is co-founder, a physician, internal medicine physician, co-founded with her husband, George Goldsmith, Compass Pathways, after their college age son had a really rough depression, OCD, and didn't find much help from traditional treatments like SSRIs. So they've been on this crusade to help make psilocybin available, first through a nonprofit, now through Compass. And, I've had some meetings with her and found her really well-meaning and bright. But it's important to know where people are coming from in their stance on even these semantics debates. Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate you giving that context, because it does help when you read an article like this, like you said, more of an opinion piece, it helps to view the article and the things said in there through the lens of perhaps the motivations of the people writing the article, right? To get us, not that they're not on here to talk about their motivations, of course. So say that with a grain of salt.
But you can imagine the motivation of Compass would be to pave the way for a smoother path to regulatory approval for psilocybin by taking out the complexities of involving an energetically charged word, psychotherapy, in the mix when, their stance is they're studying the medicine with psychological support for preparation, safety, and a little integration. Not formal psychotherapy and not what the MAPS manual or MAPS therapy training is doing. Not that level of psychotherapy, combined with the drug.
Right. So maybe we can double click on that point, because certainly, like you said, energetically charged, this term psychotherapy, but also empirically ambiguous. And that's one of the points that they try to make in the article, is that most of the modern clinical trial research that's being done on psychedelics is being done on pairing psychedelics with non-directive support. And the FDA and regulating bodies don't, that approve medications, don't regulate psychotherapies. And I think, to the point in the article, they want to be able to show to these regulating bodies that these medicines are first and foremost safe, that they are effective. And by shifting the focus from the efficacy of the psychotherapy part, of the support part, to the efficacy of the substance part, that gives a clearer picture to regulating bodies on whether or not these medicines should be approved for the conditions they're being studied for.
Yeah. And so by way of, I guess, disclaimer, you mentioned that you're a mentor for Compass Therapists, and we're also, we've announced via Numinous that we're a site for Compass's psilocybin studies. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, I guess you take that for what you will. We are helping them conduct their psilocybin research. And we can, of course, share our intentions and furthering this work and everything else. And it also gives us a firsthand experience with some of these topics. But I think conflicts of interest are everywhere, and it's mm-hmm. worth just laying them out there. In fact, I remember from my academic research days, one of my mentors saying, conflicts of interest aren't inherently a bad thing if they're well-disclosed and well-managed, because we all have them in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate that. The emphasis on transparency when you're doing work like this, I think, is important.
And I will kind of venture a guess. We had the chief medical officer of MindMed on here not too long ago mm-hmm. on the podcast. And we've also announced that we're a site for MindMed's LSD for anxiety trials. That's been such a fun study to work on, such a great group to work with. And I would guess that if we were chatting with MindMed, they'd probably agree with the terminology suggested in this article of psychological support and the de-emphasizing of psychotherapy, because we just don't know all the answers, and that's muddying the waters to try and assume we do in forging the path forward. So they're kind of, at least the authors here are suggesting, let's call it what it is and what we know, you know, let's call it psychological support, because it doesn't really fit the bill of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy in their clinical trial model and in much of what's been done at Hopkins and other places recently with psilocybin.
Right. Yeah. It's a good point, and it's why we sort of made those so-called trigger warnings at the beginning, in part because, you know, your standard therapist who's working with, let's say, ketamine in their practice, doing what they would call psychedelic assisted therapy, might read this article and at first glance feel like the authors are saying therapy isn't important. That therapists aren't the ones who should be doing this work anyway. That just anybody who's trained in a little bit of harm reduction can hold space for somebody while they're under the influence of a psychotherapy, and that it can be just as effective as if, you know, you're working with somebody who's a licensed therapist or a well-trained guide. And I don't know that that's what they're saying here. Even though they do make some statements that can feel a little jarring, like statements like, The evidence does not support that integration is really all that important, that the outcomes compared, when they compare studies that have maybe one or two so-called integration sessions versus ones that have a lot, the outcomes aren't statistically different.
Meaning we don't know yet, right? And we all have our opinions, our theories, some more well-formed than others and mm-hmm. based on different kind of sources of data and personal collective experience, perhaps. But I would point out as well that this applies to the ketamine space in many ways. Like, ketamine has been largely studied as a medicine for depression. We talk on here, others talk about the need for therapy alongside it. Mm-hmm. Based on this principle that is a little more well-founded, that as a general rule, therapy plus meds is better than meds alone. Mm. And we also know that and believe in supporting people as best we can through an experience. We don't want to leave someone alone through it. And that's not what they're suggesting. The psychological support is what they suggest instead of like formal psychotherapy as a way to describe it. And they do include integration sessions in their protocol, mm-hmm. Just like we do ideally in our ketamine work, and just like other study protocols do. But it's not the psycholytic psychotherapy over a dozen plus sessions like was being done in the 50s, 60s that we can talk about. Yeah,
I think that is, maybe we should talk about that now, because they, in the article, they do make the distinction between what they think might pair better with standard psychotherapy approaches to psychotherapy, that being the lower dose psycholytic experience, because mm-hmm. a person's generally more capable of tracking a conversation. They're more capable of introspection, of responding to what you might do in a traditional evidence-based psychotherapy approach. And so they would say to call that approach using the psycholytic doses, psychedelic assisted therapy, maybe is imprecise, because they're not actually reaching the psychedelic consciousness, right, in those lower doses. There's a reason that they had a separate term for it back then.
Yeah, and I think we've lost that a little bit. Like we preach it on here quite often, the differences between psychedelic and psycholytic psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. But maybe just to rewind, if we were having this podcast in the 50s and talking about things, it would be more clearly delineated that they're... And let's look at LSD, because it was just, for whatever reason, more widely available in psychiatry, psychology circles. There was more more psycholytic psychotherapy, especially in Europe, going on. And there was a big distinction of the psychedelic approach to LSD was done in Canada for alcoholism, mostly. Other conditions too, but that was... It was Osmond and Hoffer and colleagues doing that in Saskatchewan with good results. But if you give someone 200 micrograms or more of LSD, they're less able, like you mentioned, to engage in formal psychotherapy, much less able than at, say, 75 to 100 micrograms. So over in Europe, there was... a psychiatrist, is a Scottish psychiatrist, set up a clinic out of a psychiatric hospital. His name was Sandison, and he's credited with really kind of pioneering, pushing the psycholytic psychotherapy field, treated hundreds of clients and with small doses in a really interesting way. And so there were these two camps of how it was being used and different conditions they treat and everything like that. But the psychotherapy word becomes much more relevant, I think, in the psycholytic psychotherapy. But again, it's semantics, and you could argue it till you're blue in the face every which way of what we're doing in both cases.
Yeah. Yeah. Semantics, yes and no, though. As I think we want to, as I said before, we want to be precise in our language, especially if these two terms really do mean different interventions and different intentions. So I still think that a high dose, what we would call a psychedelic dose, right, could still be considered psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, but maybe the order of operations is different, right? Maybe you have some preparation sessions, you have a high dose experience, like a lot of these clinical trials are. And that, even though you're not doing traditional so-called psychotherapy during the high dose experience, it is shaking things loose, loosening things up. It's mm-hmm. introducing some neuroplasticity so that your psychotherapy sessions afterward might be more impactful. And they do talk a bit about that idea in the article, right?
The post...
psychedelic the preceded therapies is what he calls it.
Yeah, so it matters a lot what therapy you get next, we think. But what was studied in the paper was... preparation, dosing, well, what's studied in the modern psychedelic studies, preparation sessions, say mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, a dosing session or two, integration sessions. There might be 3, let's say, on average in a mm-hmm. psychedelic clinical trial. And integration, to call these sessions integration represents a whole new term into the the mental health field, right? Like, we didn't talk about integration sessions before psychedelics came along.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, perhaps influenced by the psychoanalytic leanings of those, of like Hoffer and Osman, like you said,
especially the European groups, like, yeah, the, yeah, that was a psychodynamic or psychoanalytic kind of approach, to bringing up, like, giving access to repressed material, mm-hmm, things like that. And there is an interesting disclaimer, that isn't from this, Goodwin paper, but back from papers. It's from a paper reviewing psycholytic psychotherapy. This is interesting. It says, it should be mentioned here that psycholytic therapy, as with all psychotherapeutic work, is not assumed that memories of the patients represent historical truth. Mm. Kind of ties into our discussion on false beliefs and, mm-hmm, things, mm-hmm, but they contain emotionally meaningful content. Memories recovered during altered states are often distorted and bizarre and must not be taken as historical anamnesis. Mm. So just putting that out there, because it's from a nice reference. And when I saw that recently, I thought it was a good summary of that conundrum that many people are facing in doing this kind of work. The work that involves kind of going to the depths of one's psyche.
Right. Yeah. So we do, therapists who are excited about or are using psychedelics in their practice, maybe we're making some assumptions about the mechanisms of change, about the process, and how to make use of those things, based on a priori beliefs that are informed by our theoretical orientations that science hasn't borne out.
Yeah.
So just to back up a little bit on the empirical questions, I think for me, I was trying to like manage my reactions to the article, mm-hmm, when I was able to sort of calm down and settle back and be like, okay, they're trying to get clear on what can be asserted based on the current data. It's not to say that, mm-hmm, that psychedelics won't be, it won't be proven later or shown later in research that certain therapies, like I was saying before, certain therapies with certain medicines for certain conditions are better than other therapies or medicine alone. That certainly, those are really interesting hypotheses, right? Interesting questions to explore. I think the article is saying we can't say with confidence, with respect to psilocybin at least, that there are specific types of therapeutic approaches that pair well. We have that Yale paper, right, that talks about acceptance and commitment therapy as potentially a really, really good framework for doing psilocybin-assisted work. But it is still just an opinion piece.
Yeah. There is a lot of work to be done on what therapy pairs best for maximal long-term outcome with which psychedelic medicine for which outcomes, mm-hmm, right? And I would say that let's separate out MDMA-assisted therapy like we've talked about. This is a classic psychedelic paper, mm-hmm, that they're talking about. And the body of literature that's growing on psychedelics, especially psilocybin, for addictive disorders tends to more and more pair the dosing with a specific intervention targeted at that addiction. And that, hasn't been studied both ways, so we can't answer clearly, but that one you can kind of see how it becomes more and more important to target the therapy for lasting change in an addictive cycle, in theory. I don't know that they talk about that in the paper much.
I don't think so.
Let me ask you this. At the beginning of this paper, they quote the definition by a European organization for psychedelic research of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. And I'll read the definition. Maybe you can tell me if you think the psychedelic clinical work, clinical trials we're doing in this modern day, say for depression, fits that bill. Like, the fundamental benefit of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy comes from the combination of psychedelic medicine and therapy. The drug is a catalyst for treatment, not a treatment in itself. In other words, psychedelics' novel therapeutic value stems from their role as enhancements to a psychotherapeutic process grounded in a relationship-centered approach that views mental health through a biopsychosocial lens. Mm. Like, sounds great and all, but the question is, you know, if you're studying psilocybin for depression and trying to get it approved by the FDA and undo all this over regulating, over scheduling, does it fit the bill in the way we're studying it of that definition? Right?
Yeah, I don't think it really matches that definition specifically, but, maybe one obnoxious point is that, you know, since I've participated in a lot of these trials now, I've been trained in being a dosing session monitor or a support person for a psychedelic experience. You know, there are all these terms that are, try to communicate maybe to regulators that, you know, this isn't a specific psychotherapy. A lot of the support strategies though, they feel like they're within the context of psychotherapy. There's certainly things that you could argue are the common factors that we attribute to a lot of the change in psychotherapy. So I don't know that it can be really, really cleanly diced apart that, you know, what we're doing is not, it may be part of what's done in psychotherapy, perhaps not a self-contained psychotherapeutic approach, but.
And I think, interestingly, you know, if psilocybin is approved by the FDA for depression or TRD, which it is fast-tracked, being studied under that fast-track designation for, the approval will likely require that one of the dosing session monitors or psychological support persons will be a psychiatrist, psychologist, psychotherapist, right? I'm guessing because it's been studied that way. And so you're right that the support that one gives during a session, you could say is psychotherapy, right? And the preparation you do that this paper mentions is so important to know what you're in for is also extremely important, could be called psychotherapy. Yeah. And then the integration sessions, even though in study protocols, it often says don't do formal psychotherapy, meaning don't do psychotherapeutic processes from different therapy modalities that might muddy the water of what we're trying to study here, because there are so many kinds and so many different approaches. Yeah.
You know, it raises another interesting, maybe more meta level question on what is a psychotherapy, right?
Yeah.
Because when you study the psychotherapy outcome literature, I mentioned those common factors. There's some really interesting studies done decades ago where, you know, they had people who would sit in a room with somebody who was just trained to be a good listener, you know, to be supportive, no formal psychotherapy training. And then, they'd sit in a room with trained psychotherapists and they measure the outcomes, meaning like people would rate their well-being or how much they enjoyed the session.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, the outcomes are fairly similar. When you're tracking outcomes that are specific to a condition, like whether or not their depression symptoms or anxiety symptoms improve, you'll see that people tend to improve a little bit more quickly with the trained psychotherapist, but they still get some benefit out of just talking to a kind human being who's paying attention to them.
And you can't call it psychotherapy in this country anyway, mm-hmm. if they're not a licensed psychotherapist, right?
Speaking of semantics, it's a little weird. Like, what is a square? Well, you'd know it when you see it. A square is a square-like thing. You know, what is a psychotherapy, right? Is that something that's done by a licensed psychotherapist?
And I'll admit that is a fuzzy line mm-hmm. to walk as a quote-unquote therapist on these clinical trials or in general, in terms of what is formal psychotherapy and what is, like, holding space, psychological support, preparation, integration, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I could tell you a little bit, maybe it's an irony, maybe it's not, but as a therapist on a Compass Pathways study, the Compass has invested a ton of money and a ton of time into training the therapists that are offering their Compass psychological support model. And, you know, a lot of the aspects of the support model include things like holding safe space, things like validation. And then there is a theory that the support model revolves around about related to avoidance, related to present moment focus, and how those things are important for a psychological, mm-hmm. for navigating a psychedelic experience in a therapeutic way or a potentially beneficial way. And you could make the argument that those things are very psychotherapeutic, I think they're trying to make the argument that no, not necessarily. We divorce those things from a specific psychotherapy approach, and we say that they're really just important for physical and psychological safety. It seems like they're leaning hard on the harm reduction safety side. Again, maybe as an olive, sort of a flagging for the regulators. But again, you could make the argument that that's very much in the realm of psychotherapy.
Yeah, and another intention they have, maybe I'll just read this part, mm-hmm. because it's on, it highlights another reason why this debate is important, is they say, finally, drug doses matter. Lower doses of serotonergic agonists will be compatible with simultaneous conventional psychotherapy, but the doses may necessarily be sub-psychedelic. This is the psycholytic therapy we're talking about. Will it then be logical to describe the approach as psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, which we do these days as a field? Our psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy tends to involve or include psycholytic approaches. We work with ketamine in both ways. Sometimes we get specific in defining psycholytic versus psychedelic, but not always, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe we should, is the point. In our view, the paper says, it will not, unless we choose to use the term psychedelic drug as a category. This would be an error of the kind that led to the naming of drug classes by indication rather than mode of action. Mm. And what they're alluding to there, I think, is things in the past that are pretty problematic, like calling a medicine an antipsychotic.
Yeah, or an antidepressant, for that matter.
Yeah, or that we use for so many other things. Like why they're saying, why would you name a drug that may have multiple uses based on that one use? And then we're faced with this challenge these days of, here's your atypical antipsychotic for sleep.
Right.
For as needed for anxiety, Seroquel as an example. Or if you're looking at on-label uses even, here's your atypical antipsychotic that we're giving you to augment your antidepressant or as a mood stabilizer. That is not helpful. Mm-hmm. And we have to do a lot of explaining. So I think they have a point. I don't know what the answer is, the alternate answer, if we were to try and avoid that down to the level of detail we're talking about here of psychedelic versus psycholytic. But
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it also brings in the separate discussion about what substances should be considered categorically psychedelic. You know, we've had a couple episodes on whether or not cannabis is a psychedelic, whether or not ketamine is a psychedelic, is MDMA really even a psychedelic? What is a psychedelic? So it's an important point, and it's going to force, hopefully, discussion around that categorization that needs to happen.
Yeah. And you know, another interesting thing comes to mind. We were talking about the way it's done these days, mm-hmm. with preparation, dosing, integration, and looking back at the early LSD history, like that Sanderson clinic in the UK where he was doing psycholytic therapy with, these were clients who were getting hospitalized to the psych hospital, who, if it seemed to fit, seemed like it might be helpful, they would start a course of psycholytic therapy. This is back in the 50s, right? And so it was a different time then. And Sanderson, a psychiatrist, went to this psych hospital when he got there that was kind of primitive and medieval. And part of his motivation was to change it, make it more humane and everything. But still, much later on, this is like 1999, there was a kind of a mini class action, if you will, by 30 or so former patients of this like NIH-funded UK clinic hospital organization, and a settlement because they claimed they were harmed by LSD, with some side effects after, like bad dreams for days on end afterwards, because they were given an experimental drug and didn't really know what they were in for. So after Sanderson's death, there was this settlement awarded that was tricky for the people to evaluate, I imagine, because like the people weren't even alive in many cases who were giving the medicine. But there were some striking stories in this. If you dig into the details of what happened then of someone just being like terrified and feeling like they were left alone. Their model actually was they had like four treatment rooms, one lead therapist on, they'd do two to four psycholytic therapy sessions at once with a sitter. But then the lead therapist would pop in on average every hour and do some psychotherapy, then go into the other room. They'd all have a group after. I mean, it sounds kind of cool in some ways, but an interesting model. Yeah.
So was maybe the thought there that there was inadequate preparation and integration. Yeah. That's kind of where these strategies came from.
They didn't know what they were in for. And so Sandison, being based in the UK, went over to visit, and being a psychopharmacologist and researcher in his own right, went over to visit Hoffman after he'd heard about LSD, and he came home with 100 vials. And like,
the good old days.
Yeah, it is a different time. Just like, you know, it was a different time when one of the authors of this paper, Charles Nemiroff, was speaking for drug companies, and like. Everyone's a lot more cautious these days of those conflicts of interest. Not saying it was good or bad, like there was clearly a settlement awarded, and I feel for the people who are harmed big time. And there were some people helped, certainly based on the data of like 1,000 clients treated in this clinic and some getting over some troubling conditions. But I think it all just highlights the need to be extra thoughtful, careful, put our biases aside as we do this work and as we try and describe it to the world and to regulators.
Yeah. Yeah. So well said, Reed. And this is coming from two guys who've said multiple times on the podcast how important preparation is, how important intentions are, how important integration is. And a lot of these are, you know, more or less supported by the data that we have. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a difference between like evidence-based practice and practice-based evidence.
Yeah.
Like there's gotta be room in here also for clinical intuition, for creativity, for the artistry side, I think, of psychotherapy, in addition to the technical side.
Yeah.
But when it comes to safety and when it comes to government regulating bodies approving whether or not certain medications become available to the public, we do need to be really, really concise, precise, and careful.
And consistent and on the same page. It would help to collectively go forward in this crusade rather than getting unnecessarily divisive or caught up in some of the weeds. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this paper is doing that. I think it's stirring a good pot to stir, right? Like I totally understand, you know, how and why it can land in an activating way for lots of people, especially if you haven't read every word of the paper or dug into it and some of the background pieces that are relevant to. But another thing I'll point out is in medicine, in the practice of medicine, I like your practice-based evidence term, about 20% of the things we prescribe are off-label.
Right.
They're prescribed for things that they're not approved for, but we can do that, and we do that, and we try to do it in the best way possible. I mean, that's the goal, and there are bad outcomes out there accidentally. There are bad players out there. But that is kind of tricky territory in the field that becomes, like you said, the art of the practice of medicine, ketamine being an example. An antipsychotic for a purpose other than psychosis in many cases is an example. And you're left with this... you're in riskier territory as a prescriber when you go into off-label prescribing, but every prescriber does it.
Right.
Yeah, for the most part.
You mentioned ketamine, and I'm going to try to like read the mind of some of our listeners. And there is a fear that what has been done with ketamine would be done with compounds like psilocybin or LSD, meaning that you'd get somebody who's not a mental health professional, take an anesthetist or something, that opens up a clinic that is pejoratively referred to as a ketamine mill, right? You have people who are just lined up in a line, given this medicine, minimal psychological support, no psychotherapy to speak of, And, you know, anybody who's done this work, who's a therapist, has had clients come to them after having an experience at a place like this, who were totally stirred up by their medicine experience and had nobody who was educated enough to hold them as they landed or to help them process what they experienced. But this paper is not advocating for that kind of work be done with psilocybin or LSD. It's, but I understand the fear, right? If the fear being, if we take the psychotherapy piece out of it, then it's just going to be, you know, your random family practice doc prescribing to take two of these and call me in the morning, psilocybin pills. But no, I don't think that's going to happen. They really are emphasizing the need for psychological support, whether they're calling it therapy or not.
They're just calling it something different.
Right.
Yeah. To avoid the troubled territories of trying to get both a new med that's a Schedule I approved and psychotherapy, which is, you know, a charge term, like we were saying anyway, like psychotherapies. The research world loves to look at what evidence a psychotherapy has for a given condition, what level of evidence. And, you know, it is helpful to look at it in a combined approach, like the dose of the medicine plus, call it what you will. In this case, they're suggesting psychological support as a more accurate and smoother path forward.
Right. Yeah. So with reference to what you said about the research world and specific psychotherapies, so in the article they say, ironically, there's no evidence that the conditions being targeted by psychedelics, for example, severe depression, PTSD, substance use disorders, are effectively treated by non-directive counseling. And they make a point earlier in the article that most of the support models or therapies that have been paired in these clinical trials are non-directive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, they're trying to support their assertion here that the studies, the data that exist right now, really, really don't support the efficacy of specific psychotherapies paired with psychedelics. Provocative statement, I think.
And even in the MDMA therapy world, like we've talked about on here, there is still this non-directive approach, and
MAPS calls it interdirected, right?
Yeah, which I like, and I like better, in fact. And also this idea of getting out of the way of the medicine, letting the inner healing intelligence come to the forefront and heal and help the person heal and grow according to their individual needs. I know that, like, all of it requires more systematic study and understanding, right? But MDMA forging ahead with these great outcomes and that approach, it brings to the surface a lot of these important questions of what do we call it and what is needed to help people in the best way, and what is needed to get these things available to people again.
Yeah. If nothing else, this article displays how difficult it is to do this type of research when you're trying to look at confounding variables. You've got these different therapists with different training. You try to give them all the same training. You have fidelity scales. You have, you know, Rater models, all this stuff. But it's really, really difficult to show that what the interventions that you are deploying are responsible for the outcomes. So I get it. I get that they're trying to be more precise and whittle away the things that might confound the results.
And if you look at, again, the authors of this paper and their backgrounds, like, yes, they all have some kind of, most have some kind of pharmaceutical industry tie, like whether it's being an executive of Compass or being a clinical trialist, right? But that also means they know what is needed for a drug to attain approval, right? Having worked in that field. And the paper says it's important to get this debate right, this terminology right, because regulatory bodies, the FDA, is asked to approve drugs with a defined efficacy and safety, not psychotherapies. Mm-hmm. Like, they are reviewing drugs, and the drug can safety and efficacy can only be established unambiguously if the psychological support is available largely to ensure safety and applied in a consistent way because any complex interaction with a therapist during an active drug experience complicates it. Therapist expectations, interpersonal dynamics, unblinding, and additionally, they say the harms that can result from interactions between therapists and patients during a psychedelic experience may not be fully appreciated is another reason they say it's important to get this right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably more we could say. I think you have you got a patient you got to go see, if I remember right.
Doing some clinical trial work.
Yeah. Any other final thoughts before we wrap it up?
No, I think bottom line is I think it's a solid, thought-provoking piece, and I understand why it's the cause for debate, and think I just consider it a conversation starter. So I've enjoyed debating it a little bit with you, Steve, and let's keep the discussion going.
Awesome. Thanks, Reed.
Okay, see ya.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.